So, the reading this morning is chapter 8 of the book of Ezra. These are the family heads and those registered with them who came up with me from Babylon during the reign of King Artaxerxes. Of the descendants of Phinehas, Gershom. Of the descendants of Ithamar, Daniel. Of the descendants of David, Hattush. Of the descendants of Shechaniah, of the descendants of Parosh, Zechariah, and with him registered 150 men. Of the descendants of Pahath-Moab, Eliehoenai, son of Zechariah, and with him 200 men. Of the descendants of Zattu, Shechaniah, son of Jehaziel, and with him 300 men. Of the descendants of Adin, Ebed, son of Jonathan, and with him 50 men. From the descendants of Elam, Jeshishiah, son of Athaliah, and with him 70 men. Of the descendants of Shephatiah, Zebediah, son of Michael, and with him 80 men. Of the descendants of Joab, Obadiah, son of Jehiel, and with him 218 men. Of the descendants of Bani, Shalomith, son of Josephiah, and with him 160 men. Of the descendants of Babai, Zechariah, son of Babai, and with him 28 men. Of the descendants of Azgad, Johanan, son of Hakartan, and with him 110 men. Of the descendants of Adonikam, the last ones, whose names were Eliphet, Jerul, and Shemaiah, and with them 60 men. Of the descendants of Bigvai, Utai, and Zakur, and with them 70 men. I assembled them at the canal that flows towards Ahava, and we camped there 3 days. When I checked among the people and the priests, I found no Levites there. So I summoned Eliezer, Ariel, Shemaiah, Elnathan, Jarib, Elnathan, Nathan, Zechariah, and Meshullam, who were leaders, and Joarib and Elnathan, who were men of learning, and I sent them to Iddo, the leader in Kasaphir. I told them what to say to Iddo and his kinsmen, the temple servants in Kasaphir, so that they may bring attendance to us for the house of our God. Because the gracious hand of our God was upon us, they brought us Sherebiah, a capable man, from the descendants of Mahli, son of Levi, son of Israel, and Sherebiah's sons and brothers, 18 men. And Hashabiah, together with Jeshishiah, from the descendants of Merari, and his brothers and nephews, 20 men. They also brought 220 of the temple servants, a body that David and the officials had established to assist the Levites. All were registered by name. There, by the Ahava canal, I proclaimed a fast, so that we might humble ourselves before God and ask him for a safe journey for us and our children with all our possessions. I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from our enemies on the road, because we had told the king, the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him, but his great anger is against all who forsake him. So we fasted and petitioned our God about this, and he answered our prayer. Then I set apart 12 of the leading priests, together with Sherebiah, Hashabiah, and 10 of their brothers. And I weighed out to them the offering of silver and gold, and the articles that the king, his advisers, his officials, and all Israel present there had donated for the house of our God. I weighed out to them 650 talents of silver, silver articles weighing 100 talents, 100 talents of gold, 20 bowls of gold valued at 1,000 derricks, and 2 fine articles of polished bronze, as precious as gold. I said to them, "You, as well as these articles, are consecrated to the Lord. The silver and gold are a freewill offering to the Lord, the God of your fathers. Guard them carefully until you weigh them out in the chambers of the house of the Lord in Jerusalem before the leading priests and the Levites and the family heads of Israel." Then the priests and the Levites received the silver and the gold and sacred articles that had been weighed out to be taken to the house of our God in Jerusalem. On the 12th day of the first month, we set out from the Ahava canal to go to Jerusalem. The hand of our God was on us, and he protected us from enemies and bandits along the way. So we arrived in Jerusalem, where we rested 3 days. On the 4th day, in the house of our God, we weighed out the silver and the gold and the sacred articles into the hands of Meremoth, son of Uriah, the priest. Eleazar, son of Phinehas, was with him, and so were the Levites, Jozabad, son of Jeshua, and Nodiah, son of Binui. Everything was accounted for by number and weight, and the entire weight was recorded at that time. Then the exiles who had returned from captivity sacrificed burnt offerings to the God of Israel. 12 bulls for all Israel, 96 rams, 77 male lambs, and a sin offering, 12 male goats. All this was a burnt offering to the Lord. They also delivered the king's orders to the royal satraps and to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, who then gave assistance to the people and to the house of God. So this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Harvest, the culmination of the arable farmer's year. Everything that he or she has planned and prepared for. Now is the time to carry it out. Now is the time to turn what has been planned and prepared for into some sort of fruitful reality. And in Ezra 8, we have reached this moment. Plans have been planned. Preparations have been prepared. Now is the time for the proverbial rubber to hit the metaphorical road. Now is the time to make a start on this particular stage of the journey into the kingdom. And so we start with a reckoning as to who's here. Ezra needs to know who he's got with them. And that's what that big long list is all about. That's what that big long list is for. That's Ezra making sure who is with us, who is here, who is part of what we're doing. I gathered the people, he says in verse 15. Well, we've seen that. There they all are. I gathered the people and then I checked. And I found that there were no Levites. And this matters. This particular instance, this matters. This is an omission. If you're rebuilding the temple, and you're serious about it, you want the Levites with you. You want them there from the start. This is not an optional extra. It's not something you can tack on a bit later. Something you can get round to when you think about it. They need to be there, the Levites. Ezra needs to have them with him. And so, what does Ezra do? These are people who need to be committed to the vision. They need to be an integral part of its execution. And so they need to be involved from the start. Some of you will know, as part of my day job, I'm involved in quite a lot of event planning. Book launches, guest speakers at the university, festivals, things like the Open Weekend that was on just now. A number of people were doing book events in that. And so, you know, at the appointed place and the time, we rock up with a couple of boxes of books and a machine for taking a credit card and all of that good stuff. And so we need to ask questions of the organisers of these events. And the big question that we ask them the most often is, are you serious? And I don't mean that in a comedy way. I don't mean that going, are you serious? I mean, saying to them, do you mean it? Is this really going to happen? Is anyone going to turn up? Why? How? So we have one for the Heritage Open Weekend, a speaker and her books, and an audience of 20. What happened? Was there just not enough publicity? Was she not very interesting? No, that's not true at all. What was not serious about the planning for that event? That it didn't quite go the way it was intended. There were other events over the Open Weekend went very well. Jenny Murray spoke at the New Hall And that room was full. So that's 350 plus. What went right with that one that went wrong with the other one? And so we ask this question a lot. We ask, what do we need? What do we need? Who do we need? And we ask, are you serious? Ezra is serious about rebuilding the temple. It's something that has to be done, and seen to be done, and seen to be done right. And for that, we need the Levites. And we need them involved right from the start. So, what does Ezra do? Ezra knew he was missing some key players. So what did he do? Did he bluff? Did he pretend that it didn't matter? Did he sort of work around it? No. He knew he didn't have any Levites, so he sent for some. It's good. It's not rocket surgery. And it's the obvious thing to do. And so he did it. And this is a problem that we have in church and indeed in life, is that when there is an obvious thing to do, we don't do it because that would be obvious. We don't go for the obvious answer because that would be obvious. I see this on quiz nights. I ask a question that has an obvious answer, and lots of people get it wrong because they overthink. Yeah. They go, well, it can't possibly be that because it must be. Come on. Yeah, it's not. I mean, I know we had this gang. What's the capital of France? F. But yeah. If we say to people, what's the capital of France? The answer really is Paris. It's not a trick question. You know, and so that's what we want. And so Ezra had something obvious to do, so that's what he did. He sent some good men, and I love that particular phrase in the passage. Because the gracious hand of God was on us, they brought us Sherebiah, a capable man. That's someone you need on your side, isn't it? So Ezra had something obvious to do, so that's what he did. He did the obvious thing. And it helped. He got it right. And then there was the next thing that Ezra had to do. And funnily enough, this time he didn't do the obvious thing. Because he needed to do the right thing. And sometimes the obvious thing and the right thing aren't exactly the same. And this is all about discernment. We've talked about this so often in previous weeks when we're looking at gifting and things like that. There's an obvious answer, and sometimes there's a not quite so obvious answer which is better. Now I've just contradicted everything I've just said for the last 5 minutes, but bear with me on this. So, first of all, Ezra doesn't have any Levites, so he does the obvious thing and sends for them. Then he needs protection along the road, so he doesn't do the obvious thing and ask the king for protection, because he's already told the king that he doesn't need it. I was ashamed to ask the king because I told him we didn't need him. And so we prayed and fasted instead. And that's good. That's good that the workaround was right this time, because the workaround involved putting God first. And so you can see that in both of these things. Ezra needed the Levites, so the way of putting God first was to go and get them. And Ezra needed protection on the road, so the way of putting God first was to pray about it. And so even though that's two slightly different ways of approaching a problem, both of them were right, because both of them centered God at the heart of the decision making. Are you serious? Ezra then gives 12 priests very, very specific instructions. Ezra's serious. Ezra has done planning. Ezra has done preparation, and now he's going to carry it out, and he's going to do it properly. And so he gives very specific instructions to the priest. Here's the things. Here's what they weigh. Here's what they're made of. Here's who you're going to give them to. Here's when you're going to do it. And again, these are specific instructions and they need to be carried out. Again, we see this with work. We see this with any kind of planning. You've got the planning, you've got the preparation, you've got the execution, the carrying out of the stuff, and you've got the delivery, the final product. And we see that all four of those stages need to be taken seriously. And at all four of those stages, there may well be a need for improvisation. There may well be a created space to allow for it. I've talked before about how we do this with the pantomime. Some of my performers are very good at improvisation, and so I write a part for them that gives them the room to do that. And sometimes in rehearsal they'll start improvising and I'll go, yes, that's very funny, but that kills the joke on the next page, so don't do that. And they don't, because they know it's a team effort and it's not just about them showing off. Partly that, but it's not entirely. And so, yeah, you've got your planning, and you do your planning seriously. And you've got your preparation, and you do your preparation seriously. And you've got the carrying out of the thing. And again, it can't be slapdash, it can't be slipshod, it can't be, oh, well, we'll get round to that, it'll be fine. And then there's the delivery, what a thing actually looks like when it's finished. And if all those three have been right, then this certainly should be. But if there's been a gap anywhere here, then the house is built on sand and deserves to fall. So what are we doing in our preparations for what the future of the church will look like? What should we be doing to seek and save the lost? Are we serious? Do we mean it? Are we hearing from everyone? Whose voices are not being heard? I rubbed up against this the hard way a few weeks recently. Who are we not listening to? Who are we not hearing from? We've seen this in American politics this week, that some voices are privileged over others. And that's not how it should be. And so when we're looking to the future of this church, when we're looking to the future of any church, who are we listening to? And who should we be listening to? What should we be doing? What should we be saying? What should we be singing to reach those who don't yet know the fullness of God? How do we do this? What do we do? We see here in Ezra that what he gives the priests, when he gives the priests instructions, they need to commit to it utterly. They need to carry them out wholeheartedly. They need to do exactly what they've been told to do, in a fairly precise manner, in order for this particular part of the task to be carried out. You see it elsewhere in the Old Testament, the instructions for building the tabernacle. I was once given that to preach on in Swathling. And it is, it's just a list of instructions. What's the curtains going to be made out of? How big are the poles going to be? How far apart? What's going to... And reading it, and talking about it, you get a very, very precise sense of what the tabernacle will look like. You can picture it in your mind even now, because the instructions are very clear. Anyone who's built a piece of furniture from IKEA can read that chapter and know exactly what needs to be done in what order and how they get bolted together and whether you're using the Allen key or the screwdriver. And the result is a tabernacle for the Lord or a cupboard that doesn't fall over. But these are precise instructions and they need to be carried out properly in order for the right thing to be done. Are we serious? What do we need to be doing for looking at the future of this church? What do we need to be thinking about? Who do we need to be talking to, listening to? How do we go about that? What does it look like? How do we get there? I've been an accredited lay preacher with the Baptist Union for 24 years now. That doesn't seem... Anyway, right, yeah. And in that time, I have been visiting speaker to a number of churches that have grown and thrived and a number of churches that haven't. I can think of one in particular... I shan't tell you where it is, but it rhymes with Mottisfont. It's not there anymore. It was an old church, and by old I mean dangerous. You weren't allowed upstairs because it was unsafe. And the congregation met at 3 o'clock on the Sunday afternoon. Everybody drove there. There were six of them, and they'd all been somewhere else to go to church in the morning. Who was this for? What were we doing? Who was I speaking to when I was the guest preacher? What purpose was I serving? What purpose were any of us serving at 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon doing that thing? Why is the church gone now? Broughton. Lovely old building. And I would go there regularly as a visiting speaker. And I would send them the list of hymns beforehand. And when we got to that hymn, if the organist didn't know it, he'd say, "I don't know that one!" And he wouldn't play it. So I'd have to sing it on my own. Yeah. And everything was run by Mrs. Davis. And she knew, you know, she'd got all it set out. And she'd got all it, and she hired the new speakers and all of that, and all of that good stuff. And Mrs. Davis died, and so did the church. It's not there now. Well, it is, but it's been converted into housing. Damerham. Lovely old church, down in the New Forest, that way. And again, half a dozen. I was the youngest person in the room by about 50 years. And lovely people, and they prayed hard and earnestly. Of all the churches I went to, when I unleashed a time of open prayer, Damerham went for it. Really, really went for it. And it's not there now, because they weren't getting in anyone else to replace them. The old congregation literally died. It doesn't just happen to churches. In the 1970s, as some of you will know, the Theatre Royal in Winchester was saved from demolition. And most of the people who saved it then regularly turned up to watch stuff at it, because after all, that's what they'd saved it for. But they didn't care what they were watching. The Theatre Royal could put on any old touring tat. And then there was murder. Whoops, there go my trousers. All starring Margaret Ashcroft of TV's The Brothers. It didn't matter what it was, because the people who'd saved the theatre just wanted to sit there and congratulate themselves for being in their theatre that they'd saved. And that audience literally died. So at about the end of the 80s, the Theatre Royal again was going, "There's nobody here. What are we going to do?"
And various managers introduced various initiatives and they turned it round, and it's the success you see of it now. And part of that was listening. Part of that was going, what should we be putting on? Who's coming to see it? How will they know? How will they find out that that's what we're doing? We used to get an Arts Council grant back at that time to put on dance pieces. And we'd say about four times a year there'd be a dance piece. And there'd be an audience of about 150, and if I thought hard enough, I could name every single one of them. But they turned up. Every time there was a dance piece, they turned up. And so we could stage more and bigger. And we got that bedrock of an audience, and they built. You know this, that when somebody enjoys something, they'll tell somebody else. And so the next time, they'll bring somebody with them. Or if not the next time, maybe the time after. But eventually. The Theatre Royal stages its own pantomime. And again, the first couple of times it was a bit tumbleweedy in terms of an audience. But they kept at it. And they made sure everybody knew. And they did things in the Brooks. And they turned up to the lighting of the Christmas lights. And they made sure that people knew. They went to where the people were. They spoke in language they could understand. And they told them what they were doing. And then led them back to where they were doing it. Does this sound familiar? No. Does this sound like something we could be doing? Because this is what Ezra did. He was serious, and he went about it in a serious way. And he thought it through, and he planned, and he prepared, and he made sure he got the right people with him, not somewhere else. And he knew who his team were, and he gave them instructions, and they were good enough to carry them out. They were capable of carrying them out. They were able to do it, and then they did it. These two do not always go together, as anyone who has worked in business will know. Is this person capable of doing the task that I've just given them? Will they? Those are two separate questions. And sometimes it doesn't work out, but sometimes it does. And this is what Ezra did. And this is why what he did matters to us. Because when they set out, as we see in verse 31, the hand of God was upon us, and he delivered us from the hand of the enemy and from ambushes along the way. Little surprises, little things that don't quite go as planned. They happen, and they got dealt with. Because the Lord was with them. And we know this. We know this. The journey to the future will not always be easy. In the book of Luke, in the Gospel, Jesus talks to his disciples. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost? To see whether he has enough to complete it. Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule him, saying, "This fellow began to build and was not able to finish." Or what king, going out to wage war against another king, will not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? Worked for Francis Drake, others not so much. If he cannot, then, when the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for the terms of peace. If you know the cost, then you can start the journey. If you've done the planning and the preparation, then you can start to carry it out. If you're just busking and improvising and going, "It'll be fine," it probably won't be. And we know this.
We've all lived long enough and done enough things at work and home and in life and family. We know this. But if God is in the journey, then he will be in the destination. If God is in the plans and the preparations, then he will be in their completion. If we listen to God, anything's possible. Anything's possible. And God will be with us when we do it.